listening to a special podcast recorded at the Royal Holloway Science Festival on March 23rd, 2013. The festival itself was a week-long event, starting with a bee opera. You can find out more about that on episode 178. Included a discussion of science facts and science fiction behind The War of the Worlds, and culminated in an open day for the public. There was a science alternative fate, displays from the departments, and us interviewing scientists in front of a live audience. This podcast is brought to you by The Pod Delusion. The Pod Delusion is a podcast about interesting things, from science to culture to politics, all from a pro-science rationalist point of view. You can find out more at poddelusion.co.uk. Our first interview of the day and the science festival was with Professor Alan Gange, head of the Biological Sciences Department.
Take it away.
I guess the first thing to do is, introduce us to, people watching on the internet right now, what you do.
Okay, I'm head of the Biological Sciences Department here at Royal Holloway, and my interest is in mushrooms, fungal fruiting in particular, and trying to understand what makes a fungus fruit.
Okay, so we're going to start way back at the beginning. What is a fungus? It's not an animal. Is it a plant?
No, it's not a plant either. To scientifically describe it, it's a multicellular organism, so it's a bit more involved than a bacterium. But it's not a plant. Fungi exist in an entire kingdom of their own, and they are some of the most important organisms on the planet. If we didn't have fungi, then nothing would decompose and nutrients wouldn't be recycled. Ecosystems would fall to a halt.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So fungi are close... This is a really stupid question, as well demonstrated. Fungi are closer to plants than... Really, they're basically plants, but ever so slightly different. There's no sentience there. I'm worried about eating mushrooms.
That's right. Yes, fungi are not plants. They're evolutionary ancient, like plants are, but they are what we call a lower organism. So, on an evolutionary scale, they would be below the plant kingdom.
Okay, and you just mentioned evolution there. When do we know when the first fungi appeared?
Well, there are fossil records that go back as far as the Devonian age. So probably before then. The problem is, how do you fossilise a fungus, of course, because there is more or less no material there. Yeah. But there are plant remains from those times which contain structures which look very similar to today's fungi that we see in plant roots today. So we can say that at least to Devonian times and probably before. So they are very, very ancient.
Oh, that's cool. So I think most of people's experience will be things like eating a mushroom, or maybe finding it in the woods. So what's the diversity? Like, there's a great variety of, like, trees and things, but what's the variety like for fungus?
It's extraordinary. We have probably no idea as how many fungal species there are. Estimates range up to several million. Much more likely that that's an underestimate. In Britain, we have something like 6,000 or 8,000 species currently identified. And most of those are what we call small brown jobs. So they are remarkably uninteresting. They're worthless from the point of view of human consumption. But again, they all do those important roles of decomposition.
So we have domesticated crops. Do we have domesticated fungi?
Yes, the few species. I mean, the white, so-called white mushroom that you buy in any supermarket is the commonest, and that's because so much scientific research has been done on how to cultivate it. It's easy. You could buy mushroom spawn, as it's called, which is the mushroom mycelium. You could buy that in a garden centre, you could take it home, and you could grow it on some rotting material. It's not hard at all. And there are a few other species, mostly in the Far East is where the majority of the interest comes, and they're beginning to appear in our supermarket shelves now, these so-called exotic mushrooms. And they all taste more or less the same, it has to be said.
There's lots of problems in places like Australia and I think here with invasive species. Does that happen with mushrooms?
Yes, and perhaps the most extraordinary tale of all is the most poisonous mushroom on the planet, which is called the death cap. Now, the death cap, its scientific name is Amanita phalloides, and it's a pretty uninteresting mushroom. It's olive green in colour. It's not spectacularly coloured in any way. It's quite large. It's about 8-10 centimetres tall. And it's fairly rare in the UK. But it was introduced into North America. And it's become an invasive species in North America, through woodlands and, curiously, along the two coastal edges, down the west coast and the east coast of America. It's colonised different woodlands to where it occurs in its home range in Europe. And it's becoming very, very common. And it seems to be out-competing the local mushroom species in those forests, and they're disappearing. We don't know why. And in America, there's a lot of research going on trying to understand just why this mushroom is so invasive.
And that's a poisonous...
It's highly poisonous.
so that's a really bad example of invasive.
Yes, that's right. What you really don't want is someone to go and eat this mushroom. A forkful will probably see you in hospital. If you ate one cap of this mushroom, which is slightly larger than the white mushrooms you buy, you would die. Unless you get your stomach pumped very quickly, but you've had it. It's a very unpleasant death indeed.
So watch where you collect mushrooms in the East and West Coast of America.
My advice is never, ever eat a mushroom unless you know what it is, unless an expert has identified it for you. The problem with mushrooms, and I think why they have this reputation, is that perfectly edible species, and some are absolutely delicious, many of those look remarkably similar to ones which will cause you a lot of harm. And just trying to identify them by the morphology of what the mushroom looks like is a dangerous business.
Well, okay then. One last simple question. Is mold and things like you get green on your cheese or green on your bread, is that the same?
Yes, it's a fungus. Yes,
well.
The mold, penicillium, for example, we all know how important penicillium is in antibiotics, and penicillium is a sort of fungus. These are what we call microfungi. There are tens of thousands of microfungi which look just like the mold you see on your bread or on your cheese. Wow. And that's more or less it, to tell you the truth, in terms of the fungal growth. In order to identify that, you must use microscopic techniques or molecular techniques to do it. Those fungi, microfungi, as the name suggests, do not produce big mushrooms. So there's a real distinction there.
Okay. So going from the more general stuff, what kind of research do you do with fungus at Royal Holloway?
Okay, well, I'm interested in the appearance of mushrooms in the wild during the year, a topic which we call phenology. Phenology is when an organism flowers or fruits or lays spawn, for example, or lays eggs. And the story I've got is my father was an amateur mushroom hunter. He was not a scientist at all. He was a stonemason by trade. And ever since I was more or less old enough to walk, he dragged me around the New Forest collecting records of mushrooms. That was his hobby, to try and find out when mushrooms were fruiting. And he did this for 60 years.
Wow.
And when he retired, he bought himself a computer, taught himself how to use Excel, and he typed 65,000 records into Microsoft Excel.
Wow.
And we used that database to do an analysis of whether mushrooms are changing in their fruiting seasons ever since the 1950s, in effect since when I was born.
That's a pretty impressive data set.
It took me a year to conduct the analyses. It was something else. But what we did find was that over that 60-year period, many mushroom species have changed their fruiting patterns in the UK dramatically. Many of them are appearing much earlier in the autumn now than they ever used to. And the fungus fruiting season, which usually goes from September to about the end of October, has more than doubled in that 50 years.
Wow. So you mentioned that there's different types of fruiting, like there's eggs and spores. Is there, like, what are the range of things of... What does fruiting entail, basically?
Fruiting entails the production of spores, ultimately. And those spores will be produced on a whole host of different types of structure. And it's actually that structure which is used by professional mycologists to identify the mushroom. With microfungi, that structure obviously is microscopic. You couldn't see it with the naked eye. But with the larger mushrooms, if you turn a mushroom over, you see it's got those little like lines, like plates almost. They're what we call the gills. And it's on those gills where the spores are produced. That mushroom is the spore-bearing structure. It's the fruit, in effect. The body of the mushroom is what we call the mycelium. And actually, that's much bigger than the mushroom. It's invisible. It's inside the soil, or it's inside leaf litter. It's inside, perhaps, dead wood. It's inside your cheese. But it's inside those sorts of substrates, and that's what's doing the decomposition. And so it's the mycelium that's the business end, if you like. That's the important part of the fungus.
So when I'm eating a giant cat mushroom thing, I'm eating all the spores?
Yes, you are. But you won't be eating all of them, because the spore-bearing cat will probably produce several billion spores. And it will already have produced some by the time that mushroom is picked. There's a huge argument in the UK as to whether mushroom picking actually affects the population of mushrooms. And in certain places, like the New Forest, where I grew up, you now have to have a license to pick mushrooms. And scientifically, I cannot find any evidence whatsoever that picking mushrooms actually affects their populations.
Where are mushrooms sort of growing on a sort of industrial scale? Presumably there's mushroom farms.
Yes,
somewhere.
There are. Yes, I mean, they look not unlike a battery farm, to tell you the truth. It'll be a large barn-like structure, temperature-controlled, light-controlled, and humidity-controlled as well. And that's more or less as simple as that. It's like a gigantic shed, but it's much more high-tech inside, of course.
So you mentioned that the fruiting change seasons have changed since the 50s. Do you think this might be climate change, or is it just different kind of patterns?
The one thing we do know is because all our records came from one very stable area, which is the New Forest, which has not seen great habitat changes over that time. We are convinced it's due to climate change. We know that the British climate has warmed since the 1950s. The last few winters, you might not think that's true, but certainly...
Especially not today.
But it's certainly, it is so. If you look at the overall 60-year trend, British climate is warmer than it used to be. The interesting thing is that the climate signal that the meteorologists have discovered, by the signal I mean when the climate began to change, is very clearly stuck in the late 1970s. That's when the climate began to get warmer. And the mushroom fruiting patterns, the changes, start at exactly that point.
Oh.
And I'm absolutely sure that it's the warming of the temperature which makes the mycelium grow more. The mycelium can then acquire more resources, greater rate of decomposition, and it can produce more mushrooms, and it produces those mushrooms earlier.
So could mushrooms be used to monitor climate change? If a miracle happened and the world got its act together and managed to rein in like CO2 emissions, would we see the fruiting patterns change again, and would that be like a good bellwether of what's going on?
Yes, absolutely. The one thing which we've discovered is that the sorts of studies which I have done have been repeated across the world with almost every taxonomic group you can imagine. But what makes our study different is that the mushrooms have the greatest and most plastic response of any taxonomic group. And by that I mean mammals, birds, fish, plants, whatever. Mushrooms seem to be much more plastic in their responses to the weather. So if we then went through a period of global cooling, as it were, I'm absolutely sure that what you say would happen, and the mushroom season would revert back to what it used to be. They are very, very sensitive indicators of climate change indeed, and I think that they could be very, very useful in the future in that respect.
Wow.
So it's almost like when the old wives tell about watching pine cones to see when it's going to... It's like that, but proper.
Pretty much, yes. That's absolutely right. The interesting thing is that the mushrooms respond on remarkably short scales to rainfall. We all know the old story of, oh, it's rained today, the mushroom pops up very quickly. And that's because the mushroom is, in effect, a balloon that's pumped full of water. So when it rains, the mushroom grows very quickly. What we've just discovered in the last few months is that the mushrooms respond to temperature changes over a much longer time scale than we ever thought. I used to think that if it was a warm summer, you would get mushrooms at a particular time. Mushrooms have a memory. The mycelium is very long-lived, and we've discovered that that memory can last tens of years. So the mushrooms can be produced in any one year in response to the climate that was prevailing maybe 10 years before.
Oh, wow. So from a biodiversity perspective... Where can mushrooms live? Are they found like in the Arctic? Can they be found in deserts?
They're found in more or less every ecosystem on the planet. Yes, there is an Antarctic mushroom.
Oh, amazing.
The diversity there, of course, is much lower. Tropical rainforest, diversity very high, but certainly all across the Northern Hemisphere in what we call the boreal forests, that's really where you'll see lots and lots of different species. Mushrooms in those systems are very, very important indeed. They do the decomposition of the forest, but also they indulge in all sorts of interesting associations with the trees themselves. And many mushrooms can be beneficial to the tree by forming these intimate associations with the tree roots.
That's amazing.
I've got a bit of a left field question.
Go for it.
So, where do magic mushrooms fit into this?
Okay, I may not give too much away here. The magic mushroom is reasonably common in Britain. It's a small grassland species. It's got a very pointy cap, so the cap is not flat like a white mushroom. It's pointed like almost like a bishop's mitre. But it's tiny. It's very, very small indeed. So the classic magic mushroom, and quite a few species have been given this title because quite a few species contain interesting chemicals that will make you have a very interesting experience, or not, as the case may be. But the classic magic mushroom is a small... really skin-coloured, sort of pale tan-coloured mushroom, grows in grassland.
Do you get a lot of students joining your course here at Royal Holloway hoping to sort of get their hands on the stuff?
I've never been up there. No, the Royal Holloway students are fine.
Very upstanding students.
That's right. No, to tell you the truth, I've never, ever been asked if they could join a degree course because they wanted to learn about magic mushrooms. Curiously, I did have I teach a course on fungal biology in my second year, and in one of my questionnaires at the end of last year, the student said she'd really enjoyed the course and she'd learnt a lot more about cooking mushrooms.
Well, I know we earlier before the science festival started, we interviewed Dr. Mark Brown about the bees. So there's a bee conservation trust. Do we have a similar kind of things that you can join and perhaps create massive data sets like your dad did?
Yes, there's a thing called the British Mycological Society, and that might seem a very old-fashioned organisation. It's not. It's mostly contained of amateur mushroom hunters. Very interesting society to join. They organise lots and lots of forays. The other thing I would recommend is, if you're at all interested, is find out where your local natural history group is. Almost every town or city in Britain will have a local natural history society. That's actually how I started. That's how I got into science. My father happened to be secretary of the society, and I was dragged out as an exhibit, almost, as someone who was interested. And that's really how my interest in science began. Local natural history societies will almost certainly have somebody who is interested. There are a few fungus groups around the UK as well. For example, in the Cotswolds, there's a really active Cotswold group. There's one in Hampshire, there's one in Yorkshire, there's one in Northern Ireland. They're the ones that are really active. They have lots of members, and they go out on fungal forays. Not just to collect things to eat, I should say. They are genuinely interested in the science. And they are incredibly important to people like me. And, you know, although I'm a professional scientist, I could not have acquired my data without the use of amateur scientists. And what we call the new trendy phrase is citizen science. It's incredibly important, I think. I think we in the UK are really, really lucky that we have such a large knowledge base amongst the amateur biologists, if you like to call them that, but people who are interested in natural history. And the subject of phenology is a perfect one. Anybody can do it. Anybody can record an event. And there are charities like the Woodland Trust who record those events. And we have massive data sets now in the UK where we can measure the changes in our flora and fauna. And it's not just of timing, it's distribution too. It's where you find things. And over that mushroom period of time, we know that certain butterfly species have dramatically changed their range in the UK. So some things, what you talk about invasive species, well, native species, which are not invasive, can double their ranges in perhaps our lifetime. And that's got to be due to the changing climate and the changing habitats in this country. And it's the citizen science which contributes to that. It's really, really important, I think.
Cool. And just to finish up, everyone but a lot of the scientists here are participating in the displays and things. Can anyone who might be interested go find you and talk to you
more
about fungus?
Yes, I'll be later on in the Bourne Laboratory. The Bourne Laboratory houses biological sciences, and I'll be back over there just probably in a few minutes, actually. You're very welcome to come and find me.
And would you say that you're a fun guy
to be
taught by when you're here?
You'd be surprised how many birthday cards I've had over the years with that on the front.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. That was absolutely fascinating.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And that's it. If you'd like to hear more interviews from the Royal Holloway Science Festival, just head over to poddilution.co.uk. You can also catch up with our over 3 years of archives from a regular show and special events like the Royal Holloway Science Festival. Thanks for listening.